So this is another audio essay, and this one is based on Schopenhauer's philosophy of pessimism. And it's an article that I wrote a while back entitled The Optimist's Guide to Schopenhauer's Pessimism. So I think that title probably gives you a sense of what the content of the essay is. It's an attempted reconstruction of Schopenhauer's famous claim that we should be very pessimistic about life because all life entails suffering. And I provide a somewhat optimistic take on that argument, being guided by the work of some recent philosophers. So I hope you enjoy this. I find Schopenhauer's work to be very stimulating and enlightening, even if it is quite pessimistic, and I hopefully my enthusiasm or interest in his work shines through in this audio essay. There are quite a number of sources used in this essay, and if you go to the original blog post that it's based on, you'll find links to all the relevant sources. So with that out of the way, let's get started and listen to this essay on The Optimist's Guide to Schopenhauer's Pessimism. Against the palpably sophistical proofs of Leibniz that this is the best of all possible worlds, we may even oppose, seriously and honestly, the proof that it is the worst of all possible worlds. Schopenhauer, The World as Will and Representation, Volume 2, page 583. In 1946, Frederick Copleston, a Jesuit priest famous for his work on the history of philosophy, wrote a book about Arthur Schopenhauer. He subtitled it The Philosopher of Pessimism. The title was appropriate. Schopenhauer was a profoundly pessimistic man. Even the philosopher-broadcaster Brian McGee, who is a staunch defender and advocate of Schopenhauer's work, concedes as much. He just thinks that it is possible to separate much of Schopenhauer's philosophy from his pessimism. He agrees that Schopenhauer was a pessimistic man, but he thinks that the majority of Schopenhauer's philosophical conclusions have nothing to do with that attitude of pessimism. But it's not clear if that is true. Schopenhauer was not shy about incorporating his pessimism into his philosophical work, and he did argue for his pessimism. Roughly, he argued that we ought to be pessimistic because of a mismatch between our desires and what is possible for us in the world. This seems to have been Copleston's point with the subtitle. He didn't just think that Schopenhauer was a psychological pessimist. He thought that Schopenhauer's entire philosophy argued for pessimistic conclusions. In a recent article, I noted that I think of myself as a pessimistic person, about certain things, and I believe that this attitude of pessimism is epistemically warranted. Nevertheless, I considered an argument for thinking that I should be more irrationally optimistic. And those who read that earlier article will know that I ultimately concluded that I probably should be more optimistic, though whether I can succeed in that aim depends on whether I can find some goal or project about which I can be optimistic. A somewhat of a catch-22. I now want to consider the opposing view, the one from Schopenhauer's philosophy. Maybe instead of being an irrational optimist, I should in fact be a rational pessimist. And maybe there is a paradox in this. Maybe if I become a rational pessimist, I will end up with a much more sanguine outlook on life. That seems to be what happened to Schopenhauer. Iris Murdoch once observed that Schopenhauer seems to have been very merry about his pessimism. And maybe I can be too. And so, in this essay, I embark upon another journey of self-discovery. I do so by first looking at a recent attempt by David Woods, in his publicly available PhD thesis, to reconstruct Schopenhauer's philosophy of pessimism. As Woods points out in this thesis, Schopenhauer's pessimism has many sources. Contrary to the prevailing philosophical wisdom, Schopenhauer presents several different arguments for pessimism, each of which is worthy of some consideration. Nevertheless, there is one argument that represents his primary case for pessimism, the argument that willing entails suffering, and I'll be focusing on that argument in what follows. I'll start with Woods' version of it, and then I'll follow up by looking at a recent paper by Alexander Billon that criticizes and modifies Schopenhauer's argument. I will conclude on a note of optimism. So let's get started. Introspect for a moment. Think about your life and your daily routines. Think about your hopes and dreams. What is the one constant across all of these introspections? According to Schopenhauer, the one constant is the sense of desire, or more properly, the sense of will. There are things about you and your environment that you want to change. You feel hungry and you desire food. You feel tired and you desire sleep. You feel ignored and you desire status. There is a gap between the world as you would like it to be and the world as it actually is, and you act through your will to fill that gap. When you succeed, you feel satisfied, maybe even happy, but then the gap opens up again, and you repeat the cycle. This constant striving and willing was, for Schopenhauer, the essence of life. This could be proved by both introspective evidence, you can feel the constant presence of the will inside your own body, and by observational evidence. Every living creature can be seen to be striving for something to change in the world. In addition to being the essence of life, the will was, for Schopenhauer, the origin of suffering and the justification for pessimism. He sets this position out in the following passage, which is worth quoting in full. He says, "All willing springs from lack, from deficiency, and thus from suffering. Fulfillment brings this to an end. Yet for one wish that is fulfilled, there remain at least 10 that are denied. Further, desiring lasts a long time. Demands and requests go on to infinity. Fulfillment is short and meted out sparingly. But even the final satisfaction itself is only apparent. The wish fulfilled at once makes way for a new one. The former is a known delusion, the latter not as yet known. No attained object of willing can give satisfaction that lasts and no longer declines. Therefore, so long as our consciousness is filled by our will, so long as we are given up to the throng of desires with its constant hopes and fears, so long as we are the subject of willing, we never obtain lasting happiness or peace." And that's from Schopenhauer, The World as Will and Representation, Volume 1, page 196. Now this passage describes the tragedy of the human condition for Schopenhauer, and there is a lot going on within it. But we can extract a relatively simple argument from the complexity, and I can set this out in somewhat formal terms. Premise 1. The will is the essence of life. Premise 2. To will something is to experience a lack or deficiency and thus to suffer. In other words, willing entails suffering. Premise 3. It is impossible to fully and finally satisfy the will. Therefore, conclusion, to be alive is to suffer, continuously. To paraphrase the famous U2 song, there is, for Schopenhauer, a reason why you still haven't found what you are looking for. You never will. Now that's a pessimistic conclusion if ever there was one. It's not all that different from what one finds in Buddhism, and Schopenhauer was heavily influenced by Eastern philosophies. But the reasons leading up to the conclusion are slightly different and more distinctively Schopenhauerian. They are also quite controversial and in need of some explanation. Now, I've already given the argument for premise one. A combination of introspection and observation reveals to us that the will is the essence of life. But what about the other two premises? What can be said in their favor? Let's look now at both in more detail. Let's start by looking at premise two and the claim that willing implies suffering. Schopenhauer's argument for this is almost logical or conceptual in nature. His claim is that if you will something, for example, if you will the presence of a cup of tea in your life, it can only be because you currently experience some deficiency with respect to the object of your will. For example, you must be thirsty and in need of comfort. You are currently in a state of deprivation, and that must be rectified. This is particularly true if the will is to be motivating. You may have some vague wishes or aspirations that do not motivate you to act. And this might imply that you don't really suffer from a deficiency with respect to the objects of those wishes and aspirations. But as soon as you are motivated to act, as soon as you will something with your bodily movements, you must be experiencing some kind of deprivation. Now this is a neat piece of reasoning, and it probably corresponds to the phenomenology of desire in many cases. It certainly chimes with the vast majority of my own experiences. If I desire food, it is because I am suffering from some degree of deprivation, however minimal that may be. That said, there are some obvious objections to this interpretation of the link between the will and suffering. One obvious objection is that sometimes it seems like we can desire or will what we already have. For example, I am currently sitting with a nice cup of tea in my hand. 10 minutes ago, I desired this cup of tea, and so I got up and I made it. Now I'm content. I have exactly what I wanted, and more importantly, I continue to want it, even though I already have it. From the first-person perspective, it doesn't feel like this continuing desire for the cup of tea stems from any deprivation or suffering. After all, I have exactly what I wanted. Schopenhauer's answer to this apparent counterexample is to simply deny that the continued desire for the cup of tea is a genuine instance of the will at work. For Schopenhauer, The will only arises when there is some action that demands a change in the existing state of affairs. Technically, Schopenhauer held that the will and bodily action have to be identical. You cannot, according to Schopenhauer, will a currently existing state of affairs. It may well be that I'm content drinking my cup of tea right now, but I'm looking at it in the wrong way. That's not an example of the will in action. 10 minutes ago, when I desired the tea and I got up and I made it, that was when the will was manifest. At that moment in time, the will did imply some deprivation. This might not be a wholly convincing response, but it is worth noting that the original objection is probably somewhat academic anyway. I am perfectly happy to accept that I can will a currently existing state of affairs. What I would say in response, however, is that the desire to maintain the present state of affairs implies, at least in part, a fear of what will happen if it is not maintained, i.e. an anticipation of some kind of suffering if the cup of tea falls from my hand. And, furthermore, there are still many examples in our lives when the will does arise from a genuine feeling of deprivation and hence from a form of suffering. A better objection to this argument is that the suffering implied by the will might not be all that great. It's probably true that when I am hungry or thirsty, I am suffering to some degree, but the degree is not that severe, and I am in the fortunate position where I can easily restore myself to a state of contented satiety. It's not like my life is made completely miserable by these occasional moments of deprivation, is it? Well, there are a few things to bear in mind by way of response. First of all, not everyone is so lucky. And even if it is easy for me to close the gap between the desire and reality in the case of things like food and hunger, there are many other scenarios in my life where the gap is much harder to close. Furthermore, and this is something David Woods emphasizes in his discussion of Schopenhauer, the many small-scale and trivial moments of suffering, over the course of a lifetime, can add up to something pretty serious. We might overlook or ignore them in the moment, but when we look back over the full sweep of our lives, the accumulated instances of micro-suffering will be significant. Well, that's enough about premise 2. What about premise 3 and the claim that the will is never satisfied? At first glance, that seems obviously false. The will, after all, is frequently satisfied. Think back to the example of the cup of tea. I had a desire for tea, I made the tea, and my will was satisfied. The philosopher Ivan Sol used this kind of argument to dismiss Schopenhauer's pessimism. In the search for full and final satisfaction, Sol seems to have taken Schopenhauer to be denying the reality of satisfaction. But Woods argues extensively against this interpretation of Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer was not denying the reality of satisfaction, he was just arguing that all satisfaction is fleeting and temporary. My present state of sated contentment will eventually pass. I will get thirsty again. It's a never-ending treadmill of desire. The only way to avoid suffering is to get off the treadmill and give up on desire. But this is easier said than done. As Schopenhauer pointed out, many people desire to have desires. This is what boredom consists of, a listless longing to find a specific desire that will capture your attention. Schopenhauer also made a deeper philosophical argument about the relationship between the will and the feeling of contentment that comes when the will is satisfied. We typically assume that we desire things because they are good for us, or because they make us happy, and this implies that we see the value of the object of our desires as primary, and the desires themselves as secondary, as something that derives from the object of desire. But this is exactly wrong. According to Schopenhauer, it's the desire, the will, that is more fundamental. Our desiring something is what makes us think it is good, or a source of happiness. Once we attain the desired thing, its goodness and happiness-inducing power dissipates. The will has to move on to something else. This is what he was getting at when he said that the wish fulfilled is a known delusion, and it is part of the reason why it is impossible to fully and finally satisfy the will. For what it's worth, I find Schopenhauer's claim that it is impossible to fully satisfy the will to be pretty plausible. The constant shifting and dissatisfaction of the will is manifest in my own life. Contentment and happiness are temporary at best and elusive at worst. This does, however, lead directly to probably the most pessimistic aspect of Schopenhauer's philosophy, his negative conception of happiness. Let's talk about that next. So, Schopenhauer argues that happiness is not a positive property. It is rather a cancelling of the evil of suffering. To quote from him, All satisfaction, or what is commonly called happiness, is really and essentially always negative only and never positive. It is not a gratification which comes to us originally and of itself, but must always be the satisfaction of a wish. That's from The World as Will and Representation, Volume 1, page 319. So the primal state for Schopenhauer is that of willing, of desiring some change. This, as was argued previously, is a state of deficiency or deprivation. When the will is satisfied, we are happy and content, but this is only because we have temporarily quieted the beast. It's not because we have entered some truly positive state of being. Think about it like this. Imagine you have a scale that measures the effective state of your life from moment to moment. We might be naturally inclined to think that this scale consists of negative affective states, states of pain, deprivation, and suffering, and positive affective states, states of happiness, joy, and fulfillment. We might also naturally think that we spend our lives bouncing back and forth from the negative to the positive ends of the scale. As natural as this thought might be, Schopenhauer argues that it is wrong. We don't spend our lives bouncing back and forth from one end of the scale to the other. We spend most of our time in the negative end of the scale, in the state of willing and desiring. We temporarily win reprieve from this by satisfying our desires and reaching the neutral point, the zero point. But we never get into the positive end, ever. In fact, the positive end doesn't exist on Schopenhauer's account. What we call happiness is just the neutral state. Now, this has some profound consequences. Some people might think that whether we should be pessimistic or optimistic depends on the empirical evidence. They might be tempted to go out into the world and add up all the positive and negative states that we and others experience and then reach some determination. If the positive states outweigh the negative, then they'd say that things aren't so bad. But if the negative states outweigh the positive, they might have a counsel of despair. But it all depends on the aggregate of total. It's not something that can be assessed a priori from the philosopher's armchair. But Schopenhauer liked his armchair. He didn't see any reason to go out into the world and tot up all the negatives and positives. After all, the so-called positives are not really positive. They are neutral. The negatives are the only states of being with an actual magnitude. They'll always outweigh the positives. He puts the point evocatively and forcefully in the following passage, which is probably one of my favorites from his work. So he says, "Far from being the character of a gift, human existence has entirely the character of a contracted debt. The calling in of this debt appears in the shape of the urgent needs, tormenting desires, and endless misery brought about through that existence. As a rule, the whole lifetime is used for paying off this debt, and yet in this way only the interest is cleared off. Repayment of capital takes place through death. And when was this debt contracted? At the begetting of life." And that's from The World as Will and Representation, Volume 2, page 580. Now, as you might have gathered, I have a lot of sympathy for Schopenhauer's view. Perhaps it is a midlife thing. When you are young and on the up, you can feel enthusiastic about the challenges and opportunities that life throws your way. But when you reach the midpoint, the routine grows tedious, and you become more aware of the descent to death. You also start to see that upward cycle for the illusion that it was. You were never really on the up. You were always on the decline. There is something paradoxically joyous in this realization. I once heard the musician and songwriter Nick Cave say that nothing made him happier than writing a sad song that captured something true about the human condition. And I agree. That's why I think there is an ebullient quality to Schopenhauer's writing. He has captured something both sad and true about the human condition, and he hasn't flinched. Yet, despite my sympathy for it, I still think that Schopenhauer's argument has its flaws. Let's start with one that I think is most obvious, the phenomenological accuracy of the negative conception of happiness. While I enjoy Schopenhauer's interpretation of happiness, it just doesn't feel right to me. When I am in a state of elation or joy, as I sometimes am, I don't experience this as a merely the surface after being submerged in suffering. It feels genuinely positive to me, like something that adds value to life and doesn't merely cancel out a debt. Now, Schopenhauer might argue that I'm wrong to think this about my happiness, but I think that's actually a tough sell. My actual experiences of happiness have to carry some epistemic weight. His negative theory might make sense within his larger philosophical scheme, but am I really more certain of his larger philosophical scheme than I am of my own feelings? I don't think so. The negative theory might apply to some cases, particularly to the feelings of satiety after satisfying some basic bodily need, but I'm not sure that it applies to all. Now, this relates to another objection, and this is one that Alexandre Billon raises in his discussion of Schopenhauer. He argues that Schopenhauer's argument for pessimism is invalid because it assumes that all happiness flows from the satisfaction of the will. But that's not obviously the case. There are, as Billon puts it, non-conative sources of happiness. That is to say, there are experiences of joy that arise without any preceding desire. Things sometimes just happen to us. A friend calls by unexpectedly and makes us laugh. Our partners surprise us with a gift. You hear a song you like on the radio. You weren't in a state of deprivation prior to these things happening, but now they make you happy. These moments of unwilled happiness aren't merely occasional, they are frequent and dotted throughout our lives. Furthermore, as Billon argues, there are some attitudes we can adopt towards the desires that we do have that mitigate or reverse any suffering they might cause. Indeed, these attitudes aren't always even conscious choices. They are just things that we naturally tend to do. And he mentions two of them. First of all, he points out that we can have eroticized desires. In other words, we can enjoy the anticipation of the satisfaction of desire just as much as the actual satisfaction. In typical Gallic style, Billon uses the example of seduction to illustrate the point. He points out that it's often the teasing and flirting that is more pleasurable than the sexual act itself. And this is true for other desires too. This means that, contrary to Schopenhauer, desiring something can actually sometimes be pleasurable and not painful. The second point is that we can have what Billon calls mourning desires. In other words, we can be quite happy and contented even though our desires remain unfulfilled and may never be fulfilled. The phenomenon of hedonic adaptation enables this. We might lose someone or something that we love and feel sad for a while, but we will then recover our baseline level of happiness. What's more, when we do this, we don't necessarily lose the desire for the thing we have lost. For example, you may still want your deceased parents back, and yet not feel any despair or unhappiness as a result of this desire. Now, both of these attitudes towards desire might be irrational, and Schopenhauer might argue that we shouldn't look on our desires in this way, but the reality is that we do. Irrational or not, our experience of the world is not as despairing or painful as Schopenhauer makes out, and that's at least some reason for hope. Now, the possibility of such irrational optimism leads Billon to develop a new and improved argument in favor of Schopenhauerian pessimism. It's a strictly rational form of pessimism, which holds that if you are being objectively rational, then you should agree roughly with what Schopenhauer has to say. I can't get into all the intricacies of this position here, and I recommend reading Billon's article if you're interested in it, but the gist of it is this. A rational person will try to do their best to fulfill their desires. And so, if they desire anything at all, they will remain at least partly dissatisfied, because they're not going to hold on to a fulfilled desire. That would be irrational. The result is that if the rational person has any desires at all, he or she is likely to be less than fully happy. And that's a somewhat pessimistic conclusion. But Billon recognizes that it's not as dramatic or potent as Schopenhauer's original conclusion. He also concedes that it's an empirical claim. The degree of unhappiness depends on how many desires can actually be fulfilled and how much dissatisfaction they cause if they remain unfulfilled. So we can't just be armchair pessimists. We have to get out into the world, experience it, study it for what it is, and not for what our philosophical system tells us that it is. So where does that leave us, and where does it leave me? Ironically, it leaves me in a slightly more optimistic mood than I began. I think there is something to what Schopenhauer has to say, and I think we can underestimate the unrelenting power of the will in our lives. But I don't think that the will is always and necessarily a cause of suffering, and I don't think the satisfaction of the will is our only source of happiness. While I suspect that I will always be somewhat gloomy in my outlook, I think that reading Schopenhauer allows me to appreciate that the glass might be half full and not half empty. He would have hated that.